everybody, it's Steve Louie here with another podcast from Grower IQ. Today we have Chris Jones with us, who has a really interesting story in cannabis from his start at Origin House to selling off his first dispensary chain and to doing it all again right now. Everybody, please welcome Chris Jones. How you doing?
Hey, Steven. Doing well. How about you?
Not too bad. Why don't you give everybody a little intro into yourself and tell us about your whirlwind story this year?
Great. So I'll give you a background going back, I guess, to the beginning of when I got into the cannabis industry, just because it gives a little bit more insight
into
what I'm doing now.
Yeah, please. So
while I was finishing my MBA, I was investing in a couple public companies as Canada around the time of Canadian legalization. Then I got a job right just about right before I finished my MBA at a company called Can Royalty. So it was a small office, small team. There was about six or seven of us. I started at a WeWork on Richmond Street in Toronto. And our company was focused on acquiring and investing companies primarily in the U.S., pretty much all only California. So at the time, California was passing, recreational cannabis use was going to be legal there. And they had, California was interesting because they had a really long standing medical program. So the infrastructure of the whole industry was pretty much built. It was just, you know, flipping the switch to, you know, allow people to open up rec stores instead of medical stores, because a lot of people in California had medical licenses. So at the time there was retail stores, there was cultivation, there was brands, advertising. So then once it flipped over, like the brands and products and, you know, access to everyone really, really exploded, and a lot of brands started rising to the top. So from Toronto, we were looking at some of these companies, and we acquired five companies during the time that I was there for about around 2 years. We invested in about three. But it was interesting to travel back and forth. So my role at the company was evaluating different companies that we were going to either, you know, invest in, partner with, or acquire. And then I would work with our finance teams, legal teams, to get the transaction completed. And I traveled a lot back and forth from here to the U.S. And I saw a lot of trends that were happening over there, even just as we hit legalization in Canada. And, you know, obviously it's taken a long time for our infrastructure to develop, but it was interesting looking at, you know, a place in the world where it wasn't that far away. A lot of the trends that are set in California usually spill over into, you know, other regions.
Right.
So looking at what was happening over there gave me a good, just good insight into what was going to be happening, you know, in Canada eventually. So then we bought a retail company in Ontario called 180 Smoke, and we were going to open up cannabis retail stores with that. Then obviously the government announced there was going to be two lotteries. So right around the time when they announced that, our company actually got acquired by a much larger U.S. company. So we went from, you know, having a few employees to acquiring five companies, you know, expanding to like 40-ish people, and then having a couple hundred employees in the U.S.
Right.
Being acquired ourselves. So when that deal was announced, it was the largest U.S. M&A transaction, like, you know, up until that time.
For cannabis.
For $1.1 billion, all stock deal.
And that was the first antitrust suit brought to cannabis.
It was interesting because I believe around that time, if the total deal value was over something like $250 million, then the U.S. Department of Justice could look into the transaction and make sure everything's, you know, everyone's playing by the rules. And there were a lot of big deals that were announced, like, you know, around the same time and afterwards. And it's interesting because I think a lot of these cannabis M&A deals are usually done a lot quicker. Like, a deal's announced and then it closes, you know, 1 to 2 months.
Right.
So because of this, what happened with the DOJ, these transactions that were supposed to take 2-3 months ended up taking, well over a year. So our transaction took a long time and a lot longer than what people thought. And it's tricky when you're, you know, two public companies and you're, you know, it's an all stock deal and you have to wait a year and you're, you know, your stocks are going up and down with each other, right? So
yeah, not to mention the difficulty multiplier of being in a semi-legal industry.
Yeah, exactly. So it took a lot longer than a lot of people thought, but it was a lot of just information gathering and waiting, right? Like, we, you know, they'd ask you questions, you'd respond, and then there'd be a period of waiting. So that took up a lot of time.
Right.
But anyways, the deal closed. So it was the first one that went through the whole process. That was
No problems, right? Like zero problems. I feel like I've read a lot of opinion that it was the feds just having a chance to take a look under the hood at one of these companies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, it closed. And then after that was done, the lotteries in Ontario, and I was looking at retail pretty closely. So we were in the process of doing a deal with one of the first round lottery winners. So I went through a lot of the AGCO early licensing process.
Right.
And from that, I saw a lot of value in the retail stores. Like I saw some of the M&A deals that were happening in the US, and you know, some of these retailers were being bought for like 2 to 4 times revenue, which is pretty crazy.
Right.
For a retail store, especially, right? So seeing that, I was like, you know what? I've been through this process. The government announced, I believe, at the end of sometime in 2018, 2019, that they were going to change after the two lotteries, they would change it to a first come, first serve process.
Right. I remember that.
So what happened was on January 2nd, everyone was able to apply for the first license, the retail operator license. So just before the end of the year, start of the new year, I was talking to a former colleague that I used to work with. And I was like, hey, you know what? Let's apply for this license, form a corporation, and just, you know, worst case, we lose a couple $1,000s. Like best case, we, you know, turn it into something special. So we formed a corporation, applied for the first license. We got it pretty quickly. So we got it sometime, I believe it was in February. So just a month after we applied, which is pretty quick compared to like, yeah. I know people that are still waiting to get it today, you know, from when they applied that date. So,
oh, dang.
Yeah. We got it pretty quick. Obviously having a, you know, very simple corporate structure, like two partners,
right.
Like not, you know, no other shareholders.
Very clean.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we got it pretty quick. Then, from that point on, we had a couple months where the government said on March 2nd, you can apply for the second license. So the second one is a site specific license called the retail store authorization. So basically, to apply for that on March 2nd, you needed to like submit the application, fill it out, pay a $4,000 fee, and you needed to attach a lease to the application.
Gotcha.
So we had a couple months between, I guess, February when we got the license, in March, so pretty quick, where we needed to think of like find a location, get a lease signed, or at least some sort of conditional offer signed. You know, think of a store name, like what we're going to call it, where is it going to be, and then who's going to pay for it, right? Just because open up a retail store, it is a lot of money, especially at the beginning. So for about a month, I was just looking around. Every contact I had, I was asking them, hey, you know, I have this idea for a retail store. I can, you know, I got my first license quick. I understand the licensing process, but obviously I don't have a very strong retail background, but I can make this work. So
right.
I asked a lot of people, everyone said no. And then finally, I found one company who was interested in putting in some cash. So they saw the value of what we could bring to the table, and obviously they had cash. So we did a deal with them where we raised close to $1 million. Me and my partner, we got diluted down. I said to him, look, we have $1 million. We put nothing into this. Like this is going to be fun. Right. So,
yeah.
So right when we got the cash, we were like, look, we need to find locations. We want to stay out of Toronto because I was just like, I spoke to some real estate, or some landlords in Toronto, and just the things that these landlords were asking for was almost criminal.
Like, oh man, any examples?
Oh, like $50,000, like non-refundable deposits, like,
oh geez,
6 months of rent up front cash.
The old cannabis tax, eh?
Just craziness. And then even the rent per square foot, it just like doubles, triples, like just craziness.
And meanwhile, just to set the context, this is all during COVID, right?
Mm. Yeah. So like this was happening. Yeah. Just at the beginning, pretty much just at the beginning of COVID. So,
okay.
So it was a very, very weird time, especially like trying to go out, see locations, like try and see people. It was very difficult to really do anything. So we decided to avoid Toronto. We were like, look, we only have $1 million. We can, you know, we can build maybe 1-2 stores in Toronto, or we can try and build many in, you know, cheaper places and places that there aren't that many stores. So that was our plan from the beginning, just because opening up a store in Toronto, it's the people we're up against have a lot more cash, and, you know, they have, it just made no sense. So
right, and Toronto's popular. I mean, we chatted about this. There's like five cannabis dispensaries that have opened up within 2 kilometers of my house in this last year.
And well, so,
heavy now, competition.
Yeah, looking at it now, obviously, is very different than looking at it then. Like at that time, there was only like 40 stores that were. I don't even think all 40 had their license. So it was
right.
It was 25 winners from the beginning, and then I think there was around 40 from the second lottery. So there wasn't that many stores open. The market was still completely pretty much open.
Right.
And so we ended up putting in a few applications. We put in 2 for Barrie, 1 for Bradford, and then shortly after afterwards another one in Innisfil. So we applied March 2nd, same time as everyone else. We got our first store open in June. So we got our first store open 3
Where was that one?
In Barrie. So the first one opened up in Barrie, that store was the second one in Barrie to open. So from, you know, basically we got the store completely built, staffed, and open in 3 months.
Wow.
From 2 guys with no retail background during COVID. So
yeah, that's amazing. COVID to boot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it was obviously challenging enough trying to open during COVID. So that store opened in June. The second one opened in July. The third one, the Innisfil store got licensed a couple weeks ago, and same with the fourth store. So basically 2 operational stores open, and 4 total licenses in less than a year. And most importantly, for very little money. Like the stores stores were built very, very cheap. Like people nowadays or right now are spending upwards of, I'd say 300,000 is low. So 300,000 to like 2 million people are spending right now on stores. And I don't even know what that includes. Like, I don't know if that's just like the floors, the ceiling, the walls, I don't know what it includes. Right. So
right.
Our stores were built for all around probably less than, I believe, 100,000 each. So we built them for cheap.
What was the footprint of your stores?
They were medium to large. So the first one, it was an interesting time as well, because getting leases from landlords at that point in time was still very difficult.
Right.
Especially because just, you know, two guys that want to open up a cannabis store in your town. It was a much different time than it is now. So it's much more difficult to get leases back then. Now it's still difficult, but, you know, easier in a way.
People have gotten used to it.
Yeah. So the first store, it was a little over 1,000 square feet. The second one was 2,400, but it was like, it had an upstairs as well. So that place was huge. The third place, a bit less than 2,000. And the fourth place, around 2,000 as well. So pretty I'd say medium to large. Right. But they're doing well. So the first store, I believe when their financials came out, just because the company that invested in us was a public one, so their financials come out. So that store, I believe, is on a run rate of like 5.5 million. And then the second store was around 3.5, I believe. And then the other two are obviously TBD. They just got licensed recently, but pretty good for, two guys or, you know, no retail background during COVID while we were both, we're also balancing our full-time jobs as well. So we're both working full-time as well.
That's incredible and good for you. I feel like a lot of people went the opposite direction and calmed down during COVID, whereas you amped up and punched through and got all this done during that period. So that's honestly amazing.
It's an interesting time. Like, I think a lot of people, you know, right now is, you know, with COVID, it's terrible for a lot, but there's, you know, a lot of business opportunity for some, right? So the timing of us doing everything was very important to its success. Like there are people who applied for stores the same time as us and still don't even have them open today. And so basically, leading into what happened with the business was, my partners made me an offer over the summer to buy my shares of the company, and I sold it to them. So that deal closed almost at the end of this September, so fairly recently.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so they bought that for a little over $500,000. So then from that, I just from speaking to customers, being in the store, seeing like the evolution of all the stores and how everyone tried to open up stores in Toronto are just getting destroyed right now. So I'm looking at, you know, what's happening today and speaking to customers. I'm like, you know what? These large stores, these expensive stores, and they just don't make any sense. They don't make any sense. And even as a customer, I go into them and it's just confusing, right? Like you walk into some of these stores, they're huge. Secondly, they have iPads everywhere. Like people don't want to touch iPads right now.
Right.
And if you do have an iPad out, that means you have to have an extra staff member just standing there all day with a little squirt gun, like spraying the iPad with sanitizer and wiping it all day. So each iPad needs multiple more employees, right?
Yeah.
Then just the layout, like you walk around these stores, there's menu boards on one side, menu boards on another. They have 200-300 SKUs. It's very confusing and complicated. And I don't think it's very consumer friendly how a lot of these stores are built and how they come off.
Right.
So from seeing that, I was like, you know what? I have a much better way that I can provide a legal cannabis retail store, and you know, the customer service and the interaction and just the speed. So my plan right now is to open up a chain of, well, I'm in the process of it, but a chain of tiny or very small cannabis retail stores. So my first location is going to be in the queue for licensing very soon. I just got all the cameras and everything recently installed. But this whole store is 353 square feet. The washroom takes up about 100 of it. So washroom's actually pretty big. So the actual retail square footage, like retail space for customers, is probably 100 square feet. It's very small.
Right. So, yeah, I think that's perfect. That's what the industry needs. When I go to these dispensaries, like both south of the border and up here, I feel like most of the money, a lot of money, is spent on aesthetic, making things beautiful and Apple Store like, etc. The size is also part of that aesthetic, and so they make these gigantic stores where they have very little product on the floor. And so like in retail, you have an idea of sales per square feet. And a lot of these guys have poor performance because they just have so much space not doing anything for them.
Yeah.
And you're going the opposite, which I think is refreshing and amazing.
Yeah. There's a lot of problems with those stores though. So I think a lot of them, it's, you know, obviously they think their store needs to be huge. So they're huge. That's the first thing.
Right.
They're just way too complicated, and they spend money on, like, I went to a store once that had a waterfall, and it's like, who's paying for that?
Right. Exactly.
Then these stores also have hundreds of SKUs. And I think the final problem is that no one really thought, you know, where a good location was going to be. So you have stores in Toronto specifically where it's, you know, there, you walk down Queen Street or anywhere downtown, there's Dundas, there's stores beside each other. There's stores across.
Right.
Like I remember I tried to take a panoramic photo. I could see 5 stores just from spinning in a circle.
It's crazy. I mean, that's endemic of Toronto though. And I feel like a lot of the major cities, especially in Canada.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think a lot of people just wanted to open stores in Toronto just to, you know, to say they have a store in Toronto, but I don't think those people are going to make money. So
definitely run into those guys. I don't know about you, Chris, but I've definitely run into guys in conventions and trade shows and whatever in the business. People that quite often it's people that have a bit of money and they just want to be in the weed business to say they're in the weed business.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, those are good people to sell your company to.
Fair comment. Sorry, I cut you off there.
Not to work with. So
this podcast is brought to you by GrowerIQ, a compliant cannabis seed to sale and cultivation management platform. The first platform to integrate all facility systems like sensors, controls, QMS, and ERP, all into a single interface. GrowerIQ changes the way cultivators use software, transforming a regulatory requirement into a platform to learn, analyze, and improve performance.
So yeah, my first store, 353 square feet. The name of the company or chain of stores is going to be Cannabis Express.
Okay.
So the look and feel is that you walk in, I have 1 to 2 employees working. They check your ID. I have 2-3 menu boards, limited number of SKUs, less than 40. And then just, you know, grab and go items, zigzags, rolling, you know, other rolling papers, lighters, sure, things like that. And we have a couple of flower SKUs, a few pre-roll SKUs, a little bit of everything, right? But we pick the best things. So we pick what the local people in the area want, and we keep our inventory costs down. So if we find something that, you know, someone doesn't happen to like, we're not stuck holding like $30,000-$50,000 worth of a, you know, an oil that no one wants, right?
Yeah, and will never be promoted again or marketed, and yeah, it just sits there.
Exactly. So my inventory carrying cost is a lot lower, and it just makes it for, you know, a cheap setup of these stores. So my first store, like start to finish, rent included, everything, like TVs, signs, everything will be done for about $30,000.
Yeah, that's incredible. Is that one going to be in Toronto?
In Brampton. So that one's
in Brampton.
Yeah, that one's in Brampton. And then I have a few other locations right now that I'm negotiating leases for. But this time around, so I just last week, so I guess me and you were speaking a couple weeks ago, but I raised a bit of money to fund the build out of these stores. So I have right now close to a million in cash right now to open up these stores. So
the next set of stores, the expresses.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot I can do with that. Like, you know, but for some,
Yeah,
for some they think, oh, it's just one store. But for me, I can build an empire with that amount of money. So the plan is to get five operational stores by the end of next year. And then, you know, they'll be generating enough cash flow to expand. So, you know, your business is in a good position when it, you know, generates enough free cash flow to, you know, for expansion. Expand.
Yeah, you don't need to dip into loans or investors. Is it the same group that has invested in Express?
Different people. So this time around, I'm working with all completely different people. The people from the last business, they're all the same and still with the last one. But yeah, gotcha. I'm with a completely different team.
And are these cannabis people?
Yeah. So some of them, the one person that I'm working with more operationally, he has more of a cannabis operations background, and then the others are more silent investors who can be helpful. You know, they, you know, give input when
right. Outside of the retail cannabis sort of.
Exactly. Just you know, people. Yeah, just investors who want to, you know, they'll help out, but they're not going to be, you know, in the store checking IDs.
Gotcha. Yeah, no kidding.
Maybe they will be. I'm gonna invite them to the grand opening. So. They actually will come. I know they'll come.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great investor that'll come in check IDs.
Yeah, you have to get in the weeds. Like people, there's a lot of people are just so disconnected from the business. Like they're not in the store. They're not talking to customers. They're not seeing what people like. Like you really, you know, the best person at the company to get advice from is the bud tender, right?
The frontline guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And if you're not there in the store day to day, like working with meeting the customers, meeting the suppliers, you know, getting feedback from, you know, just from everyone, right? Even our employees, they provide really good feedback on an assortment of products. So right. if you're not in the store, that's also another problem. You know, another big problem that people have is just they're very disconnected from the business. Like they're either, you know, they go to the store once a month or they don't even live here, right?
Yeah. How can you manage it if you don't know what's going on there?
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to ask you, during COVID, cannabis has, the consumption in Canada and the US has increased, sales have increased legal, side. And I believe on the legal side as well, but, the legal side continues to take a bigger and bigger bite out of the illegal market. From your retail POV, what do you think needs to change for, the legal market to really catch up and put the gray guys out of business?
Yeah. Well, one interesting thing happened very recently. So because of the lockdown in certain areas that just happened, I guess, at the beginning of this week, retailers are now temporarily again allowed to do curbside pickup and delivery, but only in the affected regions. So that came into effect a couple of days ago. So
okay.
This is the second time. So first what happened in the summer was they allowed it for everyone, but only for about a month.
Okay.
So it's both temporary. I saw one retailer that bought three Teslas and their plan was to do, their unique like value proposition was delivering cannabis in a Tesla. So there are people like that, right? Then the government takes it away and it's like, what do? You just signed
up.
Oh
my God.
You just bought like logistics delivery software. You have a 2-year subscription. You have Tesla. Like, what are you going to like? I guess you could drive the cars yourself, but still.
Or sell them, but like such a waste of time and money. Like that's exactly what we're saying about those retail, the other retailers.
Yeah, so right now, I really hope that people don't go too deep into the delivery, you know, sink too much money into it right now. So that's one thing that's happening.
But you're right. That's a huge one. I mean, I think the fact that these illegal guys will deliver, and quite often in the city anyway, like within a day, within an hour, some places, it's very hard to compete if you can't do that. On the legal side.
Delivery is very important, especially with the way people want to consume things right now. And even so, there are a lot of people who don't even want to leave their house, right? So they have the product come to them. You know, though the OCS does deliver. So the only other legal delivery company in Ontario is our distributor, which is the OCS. So they do have a pretty good or decent delivery option, but it's not like on demand.
Right.
You know, same day, right?
Right. Yeah, I know. It's through the post and stuff.
So that would be the first thing. Then the second thing that I think could change that would actually take a much bigger dent out of the, you know, illegal market is just allowing companies to change the limits on a lot of the products. So for example, edibles are capped at 10 milligrams per unit. So you know, removing, like, there are products you can buy right now on the illegal market that are like 1,000 or 500 chocolate bars, and those chocolate bars cost like $30. So it's like, that's tough when you're competing with like a $30 chocolate bar that's 500 megs, and like I don't know what the cheapest one at the OCS is right now, like Indiva's chocolate, it's like Bang or Legend. So those are like maybe $6 for 5 milligrams. So it's like $6, 5 milligrams. $30, 300, and you know, so that product category needs a lot of work.
Can you, for the listeners, can you go over the limits that are in place right now for Ontario?
Yeah, so it's, well, the first thing is you can only buy 20, I believe 30 grams at a time, so 30 grams total, and then they have a kind of wonky way of calculating the equivalency, like it's 30 grams of dried flower, but then you could have like, you know, a lot more milligrams in a certain edible. It's kind of strange the way they calculate it. But basically, yeah, 30 grams is the limit. And then flower, yeah, you can buy whatever. There's no cap, obviously, on the flower, same with pre-rolls. And then the edibles, yeah, it's 10 milligrams of THC per product, which is a challenge. And then the concentrates and extracts are a little bit different as well. Right. But yeah, I think the flower and the pre-roll categories right now are very, very strong. Like you can get some really good flower for like $4.20 a gram, which is pretty competitive compared to, you know, the illegal market. So I think those categories are doing well. Obviously, you know, there's a lot more producers and a lot more, companies that are licensed for production that are, you know, there's a lot of flower, just a lot of flower on the market. So it's, you know, that's a very competitive category.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, the more competitive it is between them, the, you know, some people just drop their prices to get sales, right? So it's good for customers. But I think, yeah, the edibles category, the concentrates, those two need a lot of work. Concentrates is really just starting right now.
Right. Is there a limit on how much edibles you can buy, period, like in a transaction?
It depends on which one, but it's like 30. The equivalency is 30 grams of dry flower, so it could be.
Oh, that's what you meant. I see. So yeah, edible, you can only have the THC equivalent of about 30 grams of cannabis.
Yeah, but it's kind of strange though, because I've bought products that are 5 and another one's 5, but then one counts as like 2 and the other one counts as 5. So it's kind of I'm not fully clear on like.
Well, that in and of itself, like that confusion, I could see turning away a lot of people too. I mean, it's not clear what you can do.
Yeah, but most people, like some of these products are kind of expensive. So most people aren't going to get up to the 30 gram limit. Like our average basket size was, you know, well over $50 previously.
Right? Oh, amazing. Yeah.
So, you know, people aren't buying like $400. Most people aren't buying $400, $500 at a time, right?
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
Those two product categories, I think, could use some work. And then obviously concentrates is a lot more new.
That's a huge one. Yeah.
In the market. And then just generally speaking, like the total amount of retail stores, like right now, obviously Ontario has a lot in queue to be licensed. I believe there's like 600-700, something like that, in Ontario. So there's 250 or 200 that are licensed right now. I don't know if all of them are operational. Probably like 70% are operational, 65%.
Right.
Having access, right? More retail stores. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Like
where I live, there's none around me.
Do you have an idea of a number that Ontario should settle on in terms of number of dispensaries? I think if we look at LCBOs, which in Ontario, all our liquor sales is government is done through government monopoly, and the liquor stores have about, I think, 400 to 500 stores in Ontario, and you know, provides 100% coverage. Do you think that number is feasible for dispensaries?
How many did you say?
Around 400 to 500.
Oh, yeah. So there's people calculate it differently. Like people say, you know, one store per 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. How it is in some places, like in Colorado. But if we did one per 10,000 in Ontario, we'd probably be, you know, around 1,450 stores. That's
right.
Maybe too many. But I think there's probably going to be like that. And I know the government's going to speed up the amount of licenses that they're issuing. So they went from 5 per week to 10 per week in this past September.
Oh, wow.
And I believe they're going to either double it or at least go up by another 50% in January, February. So by the end of 2021, there's going to be like, you know, there could be 500-600 stores that are licensed. I don't know how many will be open, but there'll right. be many that are licensed to open. So.
Oh, that's interesting. That's good to hear. I mean, like, yeah, as you mentioned, that'd be just having access is a huge deal.
Well, it'll be similar to what happened in Alberta, right? They just, you know, a lot of stores opened up, and there's towns of like, there were cities of like 20,000 people with like 11 stores. And you're just like, you're all fucked, like all of you.
Right? I mean, it's too many. I guess when you just let things go unregulated, I guess that might happen.
The thing is, like, you know, as long as, yeah, I don't think there should be limits on like, you know, how many. I don't like when certain places I've seen in, not in Canada, but in the US, where there's like a certain limit on like how many stores can be in a city or like a certain distance that they need to be from each other. Like, I don't think those things are good. It just ends up putting people who are like, I could be really good at getting licenses, but just like a shitty business. Right. And then I just own this town. Right. So I don't think that's fair. And it just ends up being like not good for the consumer. So I think it should be, I definitely think it should be open, but there's going to be a lot of people with very like unrealistic expectations of the return that they're going to make on these stores.
Exactly. I feel like it saves, regulating it saves a little bit of, well, not a little bit, but saves people from bankrupting themselves. Like that onslaught of, or deluge of store openings in Alberta, you know, they're not all going to last. Everybody was allowed to get in, but business laws, or like, you know, the universal laws of business are not going to allow all these stores to keep open. So they'll have a natural culling.
Yeah. But I don't think the government should put a restriction on that. Like what kind of business do they, like, what if they said, like what if it applied to other categories, right?
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's wrong or right. I'm just saying like, if you don't, if you just let it go, it's going to do the normal, like, it'll grow. Yeah.
A lot of people, like, there'll be people who make a lot of money, and most people will lose a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how it's going to be. And that's already happening right now. Like, I get calls on a daily basis from retailers who have, like, one or two stores. They're half built out. They're contractors. They haven't paid. Their landlords are trying to, like, terminate their lease.
Oh, my gosh.
They have no money. Because what happened was a lot of these people that are, like trying to open stores right now, a lot of their leases were pre-COVID. So,
especially the Ontario stores who bought, yeah, exactly. Beforehand.
Oh, yeah, most of them are before COVID. So you just see all these people pre-COVID, terrible leases, terrible locations. Huh. And then now they're still trying to open them. And it's like, you guys missed the boat.
Right. I mean, and perfect storm for your opportunity, right? And that's
yeah, exactly. Like I opened, like the thing is, we all applied, or at least most of us at the same time, right? But I got them open quick. And then these people now are all in just a terrible, terrible position, which makes, you know, the business model that I want to do right now make a lot of sense, right? Like if I can pop up right beside your big store and my store costs me less than, you know, like less than 30, 40,000 to build, and we're selling the same products. Like every retailer in Ontario, we all buy.
I think the other big advantage you have would be wait times. Like people are probably cycling through the store very quickly.
Oh, in and out, very quickly.
Yeah,
in and out in under 3 minutes, and then we'll give discounts, we'll give rewards to people to order online and come for pickup.
I mean, that's one of the things I look for when I shop. Like, I try to stay away from crowds and long lineups. That's a big deal for me. I hate that. So I'll go to the quick place.
Even if the LCBO had that, like, how nice would that be? If there was if there was a tiny LCBO near your house and you could just order online, walk over, pick it up. Obviously, they don't have, you know, 300-400 items. You know, they're limited because they're, you know, they're a small space. But if they had all the good products you wanted, you, like, people are not going to go there. You know?
Yeah. You'd cannibalize LCBO, I guess, in that case.
Yeah, exactly. So, and looking forward as well, like, one thing I was thinking about was just what happens when, you know, delivery becomes permanent and you want to have delivery hubs all over a certain city, right? Like, maybe I don't even want to be a retailer in 2 years. Maybe I just want to have delivery hubs all over the city, right? So there's a lot more flexibility that I have in this business model than people who are spending, like, you know, over $500,000 to open up just one, like, flagship store in a certain area, right? Like, they're putting all their, you know, all their eggs in one basket. And this approach just pretty much doesn't de-risk me completely, but, you know, a lot more than everyone else.
Right, that's for sure. One thing I wanted to ask you about the future of dispensaries or like the retail marketplace for cannabis was the eventual, I think, addition of consumption lounges to dispensaries. I've had the opportunity to visit a couple in the U.S. and, of course, in Amsterdam and stuff like that. And I just find that experience incredible. What do you see happening in Canada, and are you looking forward to it, et cetera?
Well, I love them. I've been to a few in California and in Nevada as well, and I really enjoyed one of them in California. It was like it was in a nice part of LA. They had half the restaurant was open, half was outside. Obviously, nice. It was, you know, a very warm day. They come out with the menu. They have their food menu, pub style food, and then they have their cannabis menu. You can order pre-rolls, flower. You can
That's so nice.
You can rent a bong. Obviously, right now you're probably not renting a bong,
right?
But yeah, you pick your item, and then you can smoke your joint. You can eat your pizza. It was a great experience. So that was a lot of fun. But obviously, right now, do I think it's feasible here as much? Like, I guess generally speaking, because of COVID, probably not. But I do know Ontario and other provinces are having public consultations about this. To figure out, you know, who's going to be able to do it. Is it going to be someone who's currently licensed? Like, I know your comment before, like, I've been to some consumption lounges where it's attached to a dispensary. And I think that's kind of strange.
Mm-hmm.
Attached or a part of a dispensary. Like,
right.
I'd rather it more be like a standalone, like, kind of lounge, like, restaurant type of place. Like, I don't know the point of it being attached to a dispensary, but that scenario, like, I would love it if they were, you know, if they were available here, but it's just challenging looking at, you know.
Would that be something you'd look at?
Oh, yeah.
For businesses?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I would definitely look at it. Obviously, the plan with my current business is, you know, grow it to a point where it's, you know, a really, you know, good asset for sale. And then after that, just obviously take the cash and look for new opportunities, right? So
right.
I think consumption could be something that's, you know, interesting to me. Obviously, I have, you know, no experience in consumption, but I didn't have any in retail, and
that's not going. Oh, you mean consumption lounges?
Yeah,
exactly. I thought you meant consumption.
Oh no, I have a lot. I have a lot of experience in consumption.
Awesome. The last thing I wanted to ask you, Chris, was what kind of software are you running at the stores? What kind of software did you buy at your previous stores, and what kind of software are you looking at picking up for your current stores?
Yeah, so there's a few different options. Obviously, you need to work with a bunch of suppliers, and one challenging thing for, you know, any cannabis business is that a lot of traditional suppliers for certain things aren't really available to cannabis. Like, even like banking is very challenging,
right?
As well, but in terms of suppliers, so for a retail store, you need obviously your point of sale software. Then if you want to do click and collect, like people come and, you know, do curbside pickup or they pick up in store, that's another software provider. If you want to have specially designed menu boards that integrate with your POS, that's another software provider. Back to delivery, like there's delivery logistics software that you can purchase.
Security, are you running software for security?
Yeah, well, for security, obviously, you have to abide by the regulations. But as long as your cameras are, you know, they're high definition, you have at least 30 days worth of storage capability, and they're running 24 hours a day, then you're good. There's a couple other, you know, smaller rules associated with it. But no, I do have to, like, I guess, software for my security systems, but it's not like it's just very, it's like a generic type of software that just works for security cameras. Gotcha. Previously we did work with, we had Cova for our POS, Dutchie for our click and collect. And then you also need a payment processor as well. So there's a lot of different software providers that you do need, but in terms of my stores right now, the POS I'm still deciding on. I'm negotiating with a couple companies for that deal.
Oh, cool.
My click and collect is Dutchie. I think Dutchie has a really good platform. I like them.
Okay.
And then for menu boards, I'm also negotiating that. So a lot of the contractors and people I'm working with this time around may be different than the last time, just because I learned the ins and outs of, you know, who's good to work with, what's
right
and what doesn't, you know, fuck up when you need it. So
yeah.
Some of my providers I am going to be changing. And then the ones I am, you know, staying with, it's definitely, those are going to be more more attractive deals than the last ones I made.
Gotcha. And how has shopping for that software been? Like, is there a lot of names? Are there brand names surfacing now? Or
There's every month, every week, there seems to be more, like, you know, service providers that pop up. But in terms of how many, like, real, like, options someone has, I'd say there's probably three to five top ones for each category. So it does take time, right? Like, you have to learn what your needs are, and then just try and see what, you know, what provider has what you need, and then, you know, does it for the right price, and obviously doesn't go down. Cause I've had experiences with, you know, you have a provider and then all of a sudden one doesn't integrate with the next. And then, you know, you can't, your debit card terminal is not working. People can't take it out, and it ends up leading to a lot of problems. So you have to, one important thing is just making sure that everything's going to integrate together before you start signing deals, because you could have, you know, like I found a really good payment processor recently who was willing to work with me for significantly less than what the other one was charging. And right now I'm talking to them about integration, because they need to integrate with everyone that I'm going to be working with.
Right.
That's one important thing. Because then you sign up some of these deals and it's like, you know, you're like, oh, they tell you they don't work together. And it's like, oh, what do you do? And you gotta, you know, kill one contract, pay them out, and then find a new provider. So that's one important thing that retailers need to do. Or any, I guess, generally speaking, any business is just making sure that's, like, you know, pretty basic, that your software all integrates together.
Right. No, that's a good point. All right. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for hanging out and doing this recording again. Do you have a website for Cannabis Express yet?
Yeah, it's up right now. We're still tweaking it, but it's www.cannabis-express, but with an X, xpress.com. The first store will be in Brampton. We're excited. It should be open, hopefully, in the next few months. We got to build pretty quick and inspect it. So we're excited for that one. And then,
when are you targeting for that one to be open?
I can't say the exact date as of yet, but just
in the
new year, and, you know, obviously before summertime.
Okay.
So yeah, that'll be the first one, and there'll be a few more that'll be announced in the next.
Awesome. Next, so everybody in the new year, go visit Chris in Brampton at his new Cannabis Express. Chris, thanks so much.
Perfect. Thanks a lot, Steven.
All right. Take it easy, man. Bye.